I remember leaving the hospital with my first son, thinking, why are they letting me leave with him? If they only knew, I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, and we get in the car, and we put in the car seat in, and his little head was like this. You know, and I saw the whole time I'm holding his head up, I'm going to suffocate him on the way home. And it was January, and our house was freezing. And I came home, he's going to freeze to death before his first day at home. So, okay, I come from a long line of warriors, so just so you know. But before we started, I walked around and asked some of you, what are some of the fears that come into your mind? See if you can relate with some of these. Well, I'm just going to scar my kids for life. That they're going to not want to have anything to do with me in the future. They might get hurt. They might die. They might be abused in some way. They might get into sex before marriage. They might rebel in those teenage years. One mom said she's already seeing it as a five-year-old. If she's doing it now, what's it going to be like in the teenage years? They'll decide they don't want anything to do with God. I won't parent them right. I won't start that good habit soon enough. My kids are in a blended family, and will they ever get along? So there's some things, so I'm sure you have some too. So I'm really excited we have Beth Hemsworth here to help us work through some of these thoughts and give us God's perspective on it. And if you've ever read the Proverbs 31 woman, she's right here. I just am so impressed with Beth. I think she's got so many incredible talents and strengths, and she uses them all for God and his purposes. She and her family were missionaries to Brazil, was it 17 years? And also as a nurse, she's been recently using those skills to help girls in Uganda. She's an incredible teacher as well. She's done the Building a New Generation parenting class here at Xenos. We have that at the Study Center if you want to check that resource out. She's also a wonderful artist. Her glass mosaics are displayed all over the country. And she has something, where's the one on downtown?
That's the Studios on High Gallery.
Studios on High Gallery. She has one on display in the window there. So check that out. And last but not least, she's also a mom of two and a grandma of soon to be four, right? And I was telling her every time I introduce her, there's another child. So, so that's pretty cool. Yeah. And Proverbs 31:28 says, her children rise up and call her blessed. And I'm sure that they do. And another part of Proverbs 31 that I thought of Beth and thought of today, it says, she's clothed with strength and dignity. She can laugh at days to come. So I thought that fits pretty well, not being a worrier. And she speaks with wisdom and faithful instruction is on her tongue. So we're really excited to have her share what she's learned over the years. So come on up, Beth. Thank you.
Thank you. I really am happy to be here. I mean, every year I come to Care Group, and it's one of my favorite days of the year because I love talking about children, and I love just thinking about, you know, how they grow and how they develop and what's going on in their heads and what's going on in ours. And most of the time when we have parenting classes, we think that it's going to be about, you know, like what time they should go to bed and what kinds of food they should eat and, you know, things like that. Well, we're not going to talk about those kinds of things today. It's almost more philosophy in a sense. It's more what do we think about? You know, I kind of chose this title, Facing the Ifs in Parenting, and I was curious to know what this title brought up in your mind, and we got a survey of some of it, but just the whole idea of if. When you think about if and you think about the future, what kinds of things are you feeling and thinking? And I hope we have a couple of microphones today so we can just pass them around and have some discussion. Anybody have some thoughts? Think about the future. Yeah.
If I don't discipline them about that issue, they're going to become a criminal.
If I don't discipline them about that issue, they're going to become a criminal. That is not a funny thought, actually. You know, I think a lot of us feel that way. And when we think about ifs, we tend to take a small thing that's happening today, and then we extrapolate. What could possibly happen? And I quickly go to the worst case scenario. You know, and think about, well, if I don't get a hold on this today, how's it going to be in the future? Well, when I started thinking about the title, I remembered the Snoopy cartoon of the life insurance, where you're taking the if. Everybody remembers that ad campaign, you take the if out of life? Yeah. Well, I thought I would look that up in Google Images and get an image of that and kind of use it just as sort of a starting point. And then I found this amazing image. Look at that. What is Snoopy doing with the if in life? Huh? Yeah, he's got it on a leash. He's got it on a leash, and it says, if, the if belongs to you. Wow. What does that mean, the if belongs to you? Just shout it out. Ideas?
We have some control over it.
We're in control. Yeah, buy my life insurance, and you'll be in control of life. But the whole idea that we could say that we are in control of the ifs and the ups and downs of life is so ludicrous that I just, I was just really, really struck by that and had to put that into today's slideshow. Because I think that all of us know that we are not in control, and that's why we have fears, you know? I've been teaching care group or groups like care group for almost 30 years now. And of all the different topics that I've done over the years, the one that has been the most repeatedly asked for again has been about fear, about talking about fear, because it's something that envelops every one of us as a parent. The second most popular one, however, has been about gratitude. How can I make my kids be more grateful for me? But, you know, the fear one, even then, the fear one, it touches it all, us all. Now, last year when I came and I spoke about fear, I talked about different developmental ages, how, you know, in the infancy, to a year, they're learning trust versus mistrust and so on. We went through the developmental stages up through even older age and talked about the fears that are common to each age and how we can address those. Well, this year we're going to talk about, and you know, you can get that CD or MP3 or whatever they have at this point now at the study center if you're interested in learning about specific fears that your child might have at certain ages. But today we're going to talk about fear in a more generalized sense. Today we want to look at how we can prepare ourselves and our children for things that will be difficult in their lives in the future. Who thinks that something difficult is likely to come up in their life in the future? Okay, we're all in agreement on that. You know, we know that there are hard things out there, and that's what drives a lot of the way we live today. And how we look at those hard things that are out there and how we prepare for those hard things that are out there will have an enormous impact on the quality of life that we have, and even the relationships that we have with our children. About 60 years ago, the world was on a precipice. It was the eve of World War II. Actually, World War II had gotten going fairly well at that point, and no one at that point knew that tens, if not hundreds, of millions of lives would be lost in that war. Now, I realize that you guys are not of a generation where that war has deeply impacted you, but just a generation back, growing up with it and with its effects and with parents involved in it and things like that, you as a child, you begin, the story slowly unfolds and you begin to learn more and more about these things that happen. And it was an event that is unimaginable to our lives today. You know, we've been at war now in our country for 12 years. That is a shocking thing all by itself. But it hasn't touched us anywhere near the way World War II did. And in the middle of the chaos of that, a very famous, I wrote that down wrong, it wasn't FDR, it was Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, in London, in England, in the 1940s, said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Now think about the context of this. Every country in the world was involved in one way or another in this war. There had already been tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives lost, and London is being bombed in this moment, and he stands up and says, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." And I'm thinking, really? You know, 1940s London, seriously? You know, there's bombs falling all over the place. I kind of fear them. And I don't know if I'm going to have anything to eat tomorrow. And, oh, I sent my children out to the countryside so that they wouldn't get bombed, but I have to stay here and work, so I wonder how they're doing. And what are they going to do if they don't have me? And, you know, if you could think about a moment for parental worries, I think that would be a pretty good one. Oh, is the earring that's making that noise? I wondered what that was. Ha-ha. Thank you. It's like, it sounded like fingernails on a chalkboard or something like that. Anyway, yes, it was ruining my story in any case. The issue here is, there's also a Christian corollary. The Christian corollary to we have nothing to fear but fear itself is just believe, right? Just have faith, everything will be okay. And sometimes we tend to take big, scary things and reduce them into little things like this. And I think this is one of the most famous platitudes of the entire 20th century, this nothing to fear but fear itself. And yet, let's think about this. We have nothing to fear but fear itself, just have faith. What is wrong with summing life up in those little phrases? What's the fallacy, if you will, in this platitude? Since most platitudes have some kind of fallacy. Any ideas? Yes. Well, it doesn't take, exactly, it doesn't actually change the situation. It doesn't take the what if away. That's exactly it. But it makes us feel like we're in control. And that's the issue here. It's all about me. It's the idea that if somehow I can remove myself into some zen-like state, you know, of okay, it's all right, you know, or just only thinking about the positive, then maybe the bad things won't really hurt me. So there is a negative thing about this, the idea of the power of positive thinking, that if we just, you know, yeah, our kids are misbehaving, yeah, there's this and yeah, there's that, but I'm just going to have faith and I'm just going to move through, is not a healthy or helpful way to face the dangers around us. On the other hand, what do these two quotes have in common that is a positive thing? What is positive and useful about something like this? Any ideas on that? Exactly, yeah.
You can choose to not be afraid. You can choose to let your faith guide you.
Exactly. We can choose to not be driven by our fears. We can choose to be guided by the faith that we have. And the most important thing here is that the truth is that our mindset has a huge impact on our ability to live with uncertainty and to respond to difficulty in ways that are both mature and constructive. I hope that's in your handout. But if you walk out from here today, and the only thing you can remember from everything that was said today is, please remember this right now. It matters what we think about and how we process our experiences. It matters what we think about and how we process our experiences. Just as an example of this, my husband happened to lose his father to cancer when he was 13. No one was there to help him process that experience. No one was there to help him understand who is God, how does God work, you know, what about evil in the world, anything. And so in his adolescent mind, what did he decide? God must not exist, or if he does exist, God doesn't care. And so because of processing that experience that way, he spent decades of his life, even as a Christian, living with that sense of insecurity that I really have to make it on my own because God doesn't care. Now, had he received the kind of, had gone through that experience with somebody who was more spiritually mature and able to see, yes, God does care. Look how God's providing for us. Look how God has cared for your father, and so on, and had a different kind of perspective, it might have changed very significantly an awful lot of things over the following decades. Is this making sense? You know, it's not what happens to us that sets the course of our life. We are not predeterministic people. Because X happened to us, Y doesn't always result. But it's all about how we process those experiences and what we learn about ourselves and about God and about life through those experiences. So this is the idea for the day. It matters what we think about and how we process our experiences. Because what does fear do? What does fear do to us? Yes. It paralyzes us. Okay, that's one of it, the sort of fight-flight sort of thing. What else? What does fear do?
Consumes your thoughts.
It consumes our thoughts. Yes, it tends to consume us. And there's one other thing, though. What else does fear do? When we're looking out at the world, what does fear do?
Makes us close in.
It gives us tunnel vision. We suddenly can't see the options. People who are in a giant room with fire escape exit written on the wall, all lit up. When the room fills up with smoke, they're so upset, so scared, so panicked, they don't even look for the exit sign oftentimes. And so fear closes off our perception of our options. And sometimes when we're afraid for our children or we're afraid about things that might happen with our children, we just revert back to kind of automatic behavior, instinctive behavior, and we don't even think about, oh, there are other options out there. There are other people I could consult. There are other ways that I can look at things. I happen to have shingles, which is why I'm not going to talk to any of you personally afterwards, because I don't want you to get it for your kids. But, you know, I will not, I mean, I admit that I have been in tears several times in the last week, but I'm not consumed by having this. I'm not on the internet every day, you know, tracking the development and all the things that could happen. Everybody's already calling me up and telling me all the things that could happen, so I don't need to go do that. It's amazing. But I'm not really consumed by this process. Now, why is that? Well, part of it's because I'm a nurse and I believe in the germ theory of disease, and I believe that it's self-limited and that it will get better and so on. But what I'm saying is we can experience pain, we can experience difficulty, but if we have categories to put it into, then we are able to see it as something transient. We're able to see it as something that we will get through and that we have resources for. Now, shingles is a very trivial example of that, but really everything we go through kind of fits into that. If we can process it and if we can understand why, you know, not why in the grand scheme of things, but the things that are happening in our lives, it diminishes our fear hugely. Okay, so this relates to our general life, but what changed when you became a parent? What changed when you became a parent and all the fears you've had all of your life, suddenly, what happened to them? They got bigger. Yeah. Why? Why is parenting such a fearful task? I have never met a parent, myself included, who sometimes doesn't have times that are just kind of dominated by fear. And our responses are often dominated by fear. What happened when we became a parent?
It's not just us.
It's not just us. Okay. Keep going with that. Our decisions affect more than just us?
What else? We're responsible for somebody.
We're responsible. That's the word I was fishing for. We're responsible for somebody else. Okay. This word, responsible, can kill us. What does it mean to be responsible for their future? Let's think about that for a minute. Are we responsible for our children's future? Are we? Yeah? In what way?
We're to teach them things. We're to help them grow. I mean, they're babies.
Okay, we have responsibilities, without doubt. Are we responsible for the way they turn out? If your child, you know, who disobeys you, becomes a criminal, as you were suggesting.
Mark my words.
What I want to get at here is the idea of the difference between being responsible, which we are not because none of us is God, and none of us can control all the things that go on in their lives, and none of us can control the hearts of our own children either and how they will respond. Being responsible versus being a steward. We are stewards of our children, and stewards have responsibilities. A steward works diligently with what they have at hand. You know, if you think of a steward as being like, you know, a director of a restaurant, manager of a restaurant, you know, he has to deal with the people that are given to him in the environment in which he works and the vegetables that are available that day and so on. We have to work with what we've got. But it's not... all of the key outcome factors are not in the control of the manager. And that is the way it is with us as parents. Some of the very key, very important aspects of our child's life are not within our control. And they are. What will happen tomorrow? You know, we've got climate change going on and all kinds of stuff like that. We've got things to worry about. We can't control that. You know, what will our income be next year? We don't know. Will our child get an illness or have an accident? We can't control that. Will our child's heart be turned towards God or turned towards self? We can't control that. And so if we think about the things we can't control and we worry about them, we can get totally overwhelmed. But if we think about it in a different way, that the God of the universe, who loves them far more than we do, has them in his hands and is through every experience of their lives, drawing them to himself, then those things that we can't control aren't quite so scary, aren't quite so big for us. If we think of ourselves as being a steward and also being as a discipler, you know, many of us are involved in a church here where we understand the idea of discipling someone, bringing them along, helping them to take one step and then another step and a step further after that. In their journey with Christ and in becoming closer with God and becoming more useful in God's hands. If we think of ourselves as being a steward and a discipler, and somehow we can let go of that idea that I am responsible, it can really lower our stress level quite a bit about how we deal with our children, because we don't have to worry, because today we had a bad day is not going to make him be a criminal. And one of the things that I think we need to do sometimes is take a deep breath and step back and say, wow, let's get my parenting role in perspective. It's not about making everything perfect for our child. You know, it's really not about whether or not they get into the best school in town. It's really not about whether or not they are healthy all the time. It's really about our being for them who we are. And I like to say this over and over again, so I'll say it at least twice. We have what our children need. We have what our child needs because we are what our child needs. And that is one of the most profound truths of parenting. We have what that little baby needs, what each of our little baby needs, because we are exactly what that little baby needs. God gave them to us because we are the person that that child needs. And that is a profound truth, because it really, you know, in the end, it won't matter if you had a bad day in 2013. It won't matter that you lost your temper in 2015. It won't matter that they didn't get the right kind of shoes when they go to school and all these kind of things. What matters is that God put you in their lives, put me in my children's lives, as the lover and encourager of their hearts. And when we set our hearts to love and encourage them, we will be what they need. And it's a surprising thing, because we think of parenting as being so complicated, but it's really not. When we used to live in the Amazon, we worked in the interior doing clinics, and so often we'd have to take the kids out of school for 10 days at a time to do a clinic trip. And the teachers would just stamp their feet and get mad, and they'd say, you know, you can't do that, and they need to be here in school, they need to be with us, they need to be learning. And I finally got to the point where I would just look them in the eye and say, no, they need to be with me more than they need to be with you. And it was true. Not that, you know, their academics didn't suffer, they didn't get their homework done very often on those trips. But the point is that parenting really, and the role of parenting, isn't all that complicated in the sense that we just need to be with them and live with them. And we don't have to be so, like, worried about every little detail of it. Well, anyway. So fear. Fear can take on as many forms as we can possibly imagine. And that's the problem, isn't it? We can imagine an awful lot of things. I saw this really interesting TED Talk the other day by a woman who's a novelist. And she had been doing some research about fear. And she told the story about some men in the 19th century who had been, their ship had sunk in the middle of the Pacific, and they were in a lifeboat. But the lifeboat was fairly well equipped, but they were like hundreds of miles from anywhere. And they knew that in one direction there was an island that they could probably get to. They had a fairly decent chance of getting to that island alive. They had enough food to get to that island, and they could navigate towards it, but they had heard that there were cannibals on that island. And so they were afraid. They imagined being, you know, killed and eaten by these cannibals. They didn't know for sure, but that was their fear. And then on the other hand, there was this other island that was 1,000 miles away, and they thought that it was unlikely that they could get there, but if they did get there, they would be safe. So which way did they choose? Which way did they go? They went to the further one. Why? Because they were so afraid of the possibility of there being cannibals on that other island, that most of them died before they were picked up by another ship when they finally made it close to that other island. And you know, we kind of like live our lives that way today. We sometimes we go for the things that we so veer away from anything that's super scary that we end up not doing the things that would make life a lot better. What are we afraid of in essence? We're afraid of pain. And pain can take many forms. It can be physical, it can be psychological, emotional, spiritual, it can be deprivation, financial deprivation. But what we're afraid of is that we're going to experience pain, or that our children are going to experience pain, and that pain will do what? Hurt them, yeah. And hurting them will, don't you get this idea, it'll ruin their lives? I mean, we move to that catastrophic thinking pretty quickly sometimes. We think about pain ruining their lives or really negatively impacting their lives. So here's one of those silly little chart things where we have the low likelihood but high scary, the cannibal island, which is, you know, we think about kidnapping or, you know, abuse of our children, things like that. And then we look at the low scary but high likelihood, the fact that our children will probably grow up to be pretty self-focused because that's the culture that we live in, or self-important. But it's not that scary, and so we tend to let them do things that will move them in that direction, but then highly protect them from things that we think might move them in the other direction. So what's the point? What point am I trying to make here with this high scary, low scary thing? Any ideas? Yeah.
We should be more diligent about the low scary, high likelihood than we are about the other.
Yeah.
But we tend to focus more of our energy and time on things that are unlikely to happen.
Exactly. We put so much emotional energy into the things that are not likely to happen to our children, or place enormous importance on things that really are not going to be the major factors of their life, like what school they get into and whether or not they get on the soccer team and all that kind of stuff. And yet we tend to lose focus and not spend the amount of time, mental time, thinking about, planning for, and moving towards the things that are less scary, but that are so much more important in the way that they are developing as people. So what do you think in the last 100 years, has the world gotten safer or gotten less safe? Is life better or worse than it used to be?
It's better as far as illnesses.
It's better as far as illnesses, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, the infant mortality is down, life expectancy is up. Is life better or worse than it was 100 years ago?
Better, more educated, we have safer
more
jobs.
Educated, safer jobs. But you know, yes.
I think it's worse.
You think it's worse, okay. Why?
Just because I think one is that as life goes on, I think you're closer to the end times and you can see that more.
Okay.
And I also think but I didn't live back then, so I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like maybe people were just as evil and
that's okay, this is the answer I wanted to fish out here. Okay. We think life is worse. One, because historically speaking, we know that we're getting closer to the end of times. We see that our world cannot continue in the way that it is indefinitely. And so we see that, and so we think that it's worse. And we also think that people are getting worse, because we see evil. I mean, you know, 20 kids just got shot in elementary school. It seems worse. It seems more evil. But let's just remember a little bit of historical reality. The streets are far safer. According to the FBI, there are far fewer homicides today than there were in 1900, 100 years ago. According to a lot of statistics, we are far, far safer than we were 100 years ago. There are 400 million of us now in the United States, so everything bad that happens, we hear about it. But it's something happening one in every 200,000 people now, instead of something happening to everybody in your neighborhood. When we lived in Brazil, in South Brazil, I conducted sort of an informal survey just because I was curious, and we knew hundreds of people, and I could not, and over a course of months, I talked to a whole bunch of people, and I asked them the question, do you know anyone who has never been robbed at gunpoint, had their house broken into, or had their car stolen? And nobody could think of a single person. Of all the hundreds of people that I knew, no one had ever not been robbed at gunpoint, had their house broken into, or had their car stolen. And it was kind of a shocking thing. And yet here in the United States, I've never had any of those things happen, and I bet most of us haven't either. We are far, far safer than we ever used to be. Childhood is far, far better than it ever has been before. I mean, really, let's think about it. None of us are from the aristocracy, right? And so all of us, you know, our parents came here, our many, many, many parents back came here, most of them as farmers and industrial workers. And until not that long ago, if we had a 12-year-old child or even an 8-year-old child, they would probably be working in a mill, working in a factory, or working in a field. And so life is so much easier now. Childhood was not really even invented until my parents' generation. Really, I mean, children were just miniature adults, and as soon as they could pick up something to work with, they would go to work, and that was just the way it was. So childhood as a category is a whole new thing, and it brings with it whole new challenges, because now our kids don't have anything to do. They're not in the field, they're not in the factory, they're not helping us with housework, because that's not considered to be cool for us to make them do that. And so they're bored to tears because they have the need to produce and the energy to produce and the desire to get things done. And they have that God-given momentum, but they don't have outlets for it. And so we spend our lives as parents trying to figure out what to help them do, how to help them not be bored. And so that's one of the reasons I think that childhood has become, and parenting has become, so much more complicated than it used to be, because we're having to spend so much time inventing things for them to do. Well, anyway, you know, because there are 400 million people in this country, we tend to have things like, you know, if five or six babies, and this is a horrible, horrible thing that five or six babies have been killed by crib rails dropping down inappropriately, but why not just fix the design of the crib instead of creating an entire new industry of crib production so that that can't ever happen to somebody else? You know what I'm saying? We are so security oriented now that we've gotten things really out of perspective. There are very real and very painful situations. And if you're in a situation where you have a child who has cancer or a major learning disability, or you're a divorced single parent or anything like that, I'm not trying to play that down at all, because those things are horrible and difficult and challenging in any era of life. But for the most of us who get up every day and life is fairly normal, our fears are usually way out of proportion with the life that we're living. So anyway, I'm just saying that as a culture, we tend to live on the defensive when we really don't need to. So what are we really afraid of? Okay, if we step back and we think, well, yeah, they're probably not going to, you know, have to work in a factory, and they're probably not going to starve, and they're probably not going to get a devastating childhood illness. What are we really afraid of with our children? And I think that when it comes right down to it, is we are afraid of emotional anguish. We're afraid that they're going to be rejected. We're afraid that people won't love them or that they won't love us. Isn't that, you know, basically the biggest fear? At least that was my biggest fear for my children and for myself, is that whole relational thing and the worrying about anguish. They won't love me. Somebody in your questions ahead said, I'm afraid my children will grow up and not love me. How many of us worry about that? You know, I did. And I don't know why, but there's just something about that bond, that you're so afraid that something could break that bond. We are afraid that they won't be happy, that someone might hurt them in a relationship, that they won't get a good job or get good advantages in life. We worry about spiritual sluggishness, which is a nice way to put it. We worry that they won't be spiritually alive kinds of people, that they won't be people who really give their hearts over to God. And we worry about the general economic breakdown. We worry about climate change and what's going to happen with that. So there are so many uncertainties in our world. There are a lot of things to worry about. And I do want to say that it is possible that we may have to return to earlier times. I mean, we know that. It is possible that our economy will be changed in such radical ways that we'll all be growing vegetables in our backyard, you know, just like they used to do during World War II, and just like they used to do forever before that. And I have to admit that one of the big advantages I feel like I have about not being fearful in this area is, having spent about half of my adult life in the developing world, I have a category for having a decent life with no car or telephone and going out every day to get food because you don't have a refrigerator. And you know what? It's really not that big a deal. You know, we worry so much, we spend so much energy worrying about what will happen if, you know, or what will happen when. But actually, a lot of those things really are the way most of the world has lived throughout history anyway, and it's not that hard. I want to bring up a 2013 vision of two of my great heroes of the Old Testament. I really love reading about the life of Joseph and the life of Daniel, and I love them in part because their lives were not dominated by fear. They lived in fearful times, and they had fear-producing lives, but they were not dominated by their fear. So here's the 2013 version of the life of Joseph. His brothers hate him. They stuff him in the trunk of a car. They drive over the border to Mexico, and they sell him to do slave labor in a factory for 13 years. Can you imagine that? Stuffed in the trunk of a car, all that uncertainty, driven to Mexico. You know, you're in a place where you don't speak the language and you're forced to work day in and day out in a factory. Well, that's really a whole lot of what Joseph's life was like. Now, Daniel, on the other hand, was a rich guy, and his city was bombed to ashes. His people were slaughtered, but he was spared so that he could be a slave to the conquering government, and he was sent to a harsh boarding school in another language. So he had to deal with survival guilt, cultural loss, confusion, learning a new language. And he probably never saw most of his friends and family again by the time he got to Babylon. So here's my question. And remember, they were both teenagers. They were not even adults, mature adults, to cope with all these things. They were teenagers. Why did these stressed out teenagers become famous men of faith? And Joseph's story is particularly poignant and particularly famous because his is also a story of forgiveness. So why did these stressed out teenagers in the most horrible circumstances we can imagine become models of faith for us? What happened? They depended on the Lord, okay? Now let's pull that out a little bit. What does that mean? They depended on the Lord. They were, if you could just repeat that so people can hear it.
Rather than focusing on their circumstances and situations, they talked to God about it. They believed that He had their best interest at heart, and He was going to help them through that.
Yeah, they really did believe that the God of the universe knew where they were. When Joseph was in the well or the trunk of the car, you know, when Daniel was being taken off to Babylon after seeing the destruction of his entire city and nation, they truly believed that God knew where they were on the planet, yeah, and that God was with them, and that they were going to seek out the things that were most important. And as they set their minds on the things that were really most important, then God prospered them through the lives that they had. I ran into a verse some long while ago that has been in my mind over and over again, and it's in 1 Peter 4:1, and it says, "He who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin." Now, I think that's a really strange or interesting idea. The whole verse goes like this: "Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with this same attitude, because whoever suffers in the body is done with sin." Or in the NASB it says, "Because whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin." What does that mean? If you've suffered in the flesh, you've ceased from sin. I mean, I've suffered a fair amount off and on. I certainly haven't ceased from sin. So there's a principle here. What does it mean? If you've suffered in the flesh, you've ceased from sin. Any ideas? No takers on this one? You could be transformed through it, okay.
More loving, more like Christ.
More loving, okay. Did you have an idea also?
Oh, I was just going to say, it's the effect that suffering has in our lives, like that's maybe what actually builds veracity.
Okay, exactly. The effect that suffering has on our life is what builds, did you say veracity?
Yeah.
It's a wonderful word. It's true. It builds veracity, and veracity means truth, but not just objective truth, but also a harmony of truth within us, okay? So it builds a cohesive life for us. Suffering clears our heads. Has anybody been to a funeral or a memorial service lately? Okay, what happens when you're at a funeral? What kinds of things do you think about? What kinds of things do you think about? Your own mortality, okay, that I'm going to be there someday. What else do you think about? Yes?
The material wealth they had didn't really mean much.
The material wealth didn't really mean much? Okay, what else?
Make the most of the time that you have.
Make the most of the time you have. In what regard?
Well, as a Christian, make most of the time loving people, loving God, and not be focused on the insignificant things. It really focuses on what's really important and what's not.
Absolutely. Anything else? Did you have your hand up? Okay, so... Has anybody, what?
Your own loss.
Your own loss? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do focus on our loss. And that loss reminds us of the grand scheme of things, the greater perspective. Has anyone ever walked away from a funeral thinking, boy, I really should spend more time at work and stop wasting so much time with my kids? Have you ever experienced that or heard anybody say that? Has anybody ever come to the end of their life and said something like that? No. Because when we are facing loss and we're facing suffering, it clears our heads and it gives us great perspective. There's a certain sense in which it would be really helpful for us to wake up every day thinking about going to a funeral. because it clears out our head. It teaches us what's important. And it teaches us what's important by stripping away the things that we can't take with us and stripping away all of the pretense of what life is all about and reminding us that really what it's all about is our relationship with God and the relationship with people about us, because people are the only things that are eternal. And so it's a really, really helpful thing. So now we answer the question, how did Joseph and Daniel survive, thrive, and become really mature examples of faith? It's because they lived every day with suffering. And every day they had to get up and decide what was true. And every day they had to reach out to the God of the universe. Now, we think about being in a really overwhelming situation, and we think, well, what's this God of the universe going to do for me? What did God do for them in their lives that enabled them to bear up and thrive in these crazy circumstances? What can God really do? Yeah. It's a redeeming thing. God is working a process in our hearts, okay? So what about that? What about suffering is redeeming? Or potentially redeeming? Sometimes it destroys us. If we decide we're going to handle suffering all by ourselves, it will destroy us. But if we reach out to God when we suffer, how does it redeem us?
We see that he can
gives us strength, yes?
We see that he can carry us. I think about the verse, I know it's more about discipline, but all discipline at the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful, but afterward it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. And I just think about when I go through suffering and I'm relying on God, I see that he can carry me through the worst.
Absolutely. And then you're not as afraid of suffering later, because you realize you've been through suffering, you've survived it, and it's kind of like, you know, getting back on the horse kind of a thing. But the key here for all of us to think about, and to think about really clearly, is that the ability to deal with suffering is a supernatural thing. We don't have it in ourselves. So when we say there's nothing to fear but fear itself, or just have faith, that's not really quite so true. But the thing is that the Holy Spirit really does exist. And the Holy Spirit really is at work in our lives. And the Holy Spirit really does do impossible things, like give us the ability to deal with a kind of suffering that we thought would have destroyed us. We really thought would have destroyed us. And yet he's able to give us something totally new. Kelly?
When I think about that, I think, like, in and of ourselves, suffering produces lies.
Great. Here, say that again.
I was saying, in and of ourselves, like, suffering produces lies, like, I won't overcome this, this will never be better, whereas relying on the Holy Spirit, we see truth. We see that, no, this is not the end of us, this is not going to destroy us, and in the truth of that I would never think on my own.
Yes.
You know, like, for example, like, I often say, I wish I wouldn't have lost my mom at such a young age, but because I did, I am a person who asks for help. I am a person who doesn't rely on myself or mm-hmm. just my family for things, but I seek other people, whereas I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't have been that way as a young mom if my mom would have been here, you mm-hmm. know? So just different things like that, that I don't think I would have come to those conclusions of myself if I would have just let the suffering consume me.
Excellent. That is so correct. That the Holy Spirit speaks to us and speaks truth to our hearts, because we really do hear a lot of lies. Whenever we suffer, we hear God doesn't care, God isn't going to intervene, you know, I have to take care of myself. Those are the kind of things that come through our head, and the Holy Spirit is the one who speaks truth. Yes?
I was just going to say, is it on? Okay. I was just going to say, the effect that God wants to have ultimately on others and his plan. And you think of Joseph and he's like, you meant this for evil, but God meant it for good uh-huh. so that I may preserve life. So it wasn't even so much about what God was teaching Joseph, but just the plan that God had for that nation. And so it builds a certain type of person that he can do his work through, you know.
Both of those men went through experiences that were so devastating that they realized that life was not about them. And they, putting themselves in God's hands, were used in amazing ways for millennia. How many thousands of years ago? 3,000 years ago, these things happened to Daniel. And early, even earlier than that, to Joseph. And yet, for all these thousands of years, their lives have been useful to us because they got that. that one of the things that suffering does is it either causes us to focus totally on ourselves and incapacitates us, or it causes us to look outside and say, there's something bigger than me, and there's something that that big guy wants to do in my life and use me for. And these are wonderful, wonderful things. I have a friend with arthritis who needs a hip replacement sometime this year. And she's always been a little bit less social than some people. And she has become so hospitable and so generous and so others-focused and has been picking up Chinese students at the airport and bringing them to her home and having people come and live with her and doing all kinds of things on a relational level that I just haven't seen before. You know, and you ask her, what happened? What has changed the way you're able to relate to people? She says, I live with pain every day. And it reminds me that I just want to go to heaven. And then when I think about I just want to go to heaven, then I think about what's really important in life. And it has changed her life. This, you know, this need for hip replacement has changed her life. It's an amazing thing. So these are the things we worry about, is the emotional devastation. And yet we know that if we help our children to access the Holy Spirit, to really come alive in their relationship with Jesus, they will not just survive those difficult years, but they will thrive and become people who can contribute in really mature ways. Now, here's something I think is super important, and that is this. A person who is not fearful, okay, a person who really, really does believe that the God of the universe is out there and that the Holy Spirit is a real person and that they're really not walking alone in this world, a person who is not fearful is freed to make decisions on the long-term merit of the choices and not on the short-term risk of pain. Does that make sense? Okay. Anybody have an example or an idea about how that might work? We're able to make commitments. While you guys think about this, let me just say one thing. There's an interesting book that was just put out by a guy named Sebastian Younger. He wrote the book Perfect Storm. You guys remember Perfect Storm? Yeah. He just wrote a book called War. It's about Afghanistan. He was embedded with troops in Afghanistan for 15 months. And he has some fascinating things to say about heroism and how soldiers work and things like that. And he was looking at the issue of the courage of the type that soldiers exhibit. And as a total non-believer, he has come to this really perplexing conclusion that courage makes no evolutionary sense. Courage makes no sense from an evolutionary perspective. And he did some studies or accessed some studies about animal behavior, and he found that male primates will fight to the death when they're all together protecting their troop. But if one of the males gets separated from their troop and the other males from the other troop are beating up on him, they never go back. They never go to the rescue of this one. They don't exhibit courage in that sense. There's no altruism in it. And so he's saying that self-sacrifice on the large scale makes no rational sense. And we fall into that. We fall into becoming evolutionary materialists when we think that something that might sacrifice our time or ourself or put us at emotional risk or put us at physical risk is a bad thing, you know? Because if we are not fearful, we're freed to make decisions based on long-term merit, not short-term possibility or risk of pain. So has anybody had some time to think about an example of how that might work? There you go.
Well, in our marriage, I'm the fearful one and my husband's not. So this week it played out and he found a trampoline for $40. My first comment was, does that pay for the x-rays and broken arms too? and he told me, he said, him and his friends had one, and he told me about all the times that they played on that thing and had sleepovers on it and how it brought neighborhood kids over. And he has this long-term vision of it building relationships with our kids and them with the neighbors, and I just see the short risk pain.
That is a perfect example. That is great.
That's like the small scale, but he's pushed me in a lot of ways. Another way, he has been doing orphan care and had wanted us to take our girls who were 1, 3, and 5 at the time to go for a summer down to Mexico, which is exactly the place where all the gang wars were going on. And
spiders and things.
I was just like, and even we were gonna be in a one bedroom apartment, and I was like, 5 people, we're not gonna sleep for a summer, this is gonna be horrible. And everything was based on fear. And I mean, he prayed for me a long time, but he ended up telling me the long-term merits that that would have of being, you know, willing to take risks like that, and for our girls to live in a different culture, and for the joy of them having friends who are orphans that they can continue to pray for. And I mean, it ended up changing my heart probably more than anyone else's, but mm-hmm. I'm glad that that he's really good at that stuff.
Well, I couldn't have lined up a better testimony of what I'm trying to say. That is fantastic. That is exactly what I'm trying to say. When we live with fear, we have tunnel vision, and somebody thinks, go to Mexico for a summer with my little kids, and there's just no way that that fits into that tunnel. You know, and when we're freed from fear, we're able to look at the possibilities of life, and we're able to encounter things that we never would have thought we could do. And one of the things that, that Younger, Sebastian Younger, a conclusion that he reached in talking to lots of soldiers and firemen and policemen and all that, they do very brave things. They do brave acts. But yet when people compliment them for that, say, oh, that was a very brave thing, they tend to say, I was just doing my job. And he was very curious about that mentality. And he found that among people who do heroic things, the point of commitment to heroism is not the day they get up and the house is burning down. It's not the day they go out on patrol and their buddy gets shot. The moment that they commit to heroism is the day that they sign up for the Army. Okay, they're making a commitment. And when we make certain kinds of commitments then, they have certain kinds of implications. And then doing what we need to do just seems to come naturally and flow out of those commitments. Now this is not anywhere near as dramatic, but I remember one night we were in a medical boat in the jungle, days away from any kind of town or village other than just a little teeny-weeny little community. And in the middle of the night, two men came to our medical boat in a canoe and asked for the nurse because they said that there was a girl who was bleeding, who had a lot of postpartum bleeding in their community. And at that time, it happened that it was just my husband and I and our two kids who were on the boat. I don't remember where the rest of the crew was that particular night, but we were by ourselves. And so obviously my husband could not come with me on this little jaunt into the jungle. And so there had to be a choice made. Do I, you know, we can't leave our two kids alone. Do I get into a little dugout canoe with two men that I've never met and disappear into the jungle in the middle of the night and assume that we're going to a village that has a young woman who has just given birth? You know, and at the time it seemed like a pretty rational choice. You get in the canoe and you pray that that's where you're really going and you go there and then you meet the young girl and take care of her and you get back in the canoe and you come back. You know, as I look about it, sometimes I look at things like that later and I think, well, was that smart? You know, was that a good idea? You know, but it's our commitments. And it's the valuing of the things that we're doing that frees us up from fear. And we can live our life on the day in and day out basis, not being, sure, we have fears, but not being controlled by fear. And do you see the huge difference between having fears? I will always have fears, you know, but I don't have to live with my life controlled by fear because I really do believe in the reality of the Holy Spirit and that he's always there and always moving. Not always keeping bad things from happening, but always there and always moving. So suffering clears our heads. And I think that this is a super, super important thing. The most common exhortation in the Bible is what? Don't be afraid. That is the most common command the guy gives to us is don't be afraid. You know, get your head on about who's really in charge. Okay. Is courage the opposite of fear? I think what I've been saying is that courage is a process. Courage is something that comes to us almost naturally when we have made certain kinds of commitments. And that courage doesn't mean that we don't have fear, but courage means that we're able to act on our commitments in spite of any fears that we have. All right. Here's the question of the day. How does avoiding pain drive our lives? What difference does it make to us? And I think we've already answered some of that, but let's get some more answers going. How does fear of pain or avoiding pain drive our lives?
It becomes an idol.
There you go, there's the microphone.
Oh, sorry.
As a sufferer of the idol of comfort, like it takes over. Like you can't see the things of God because you're constantly trying to be comfortable rather
right.
than
living a comfortable life becomes like the goal, you know, like the goal of the Christian life is to get all of our ducks in a row and live this predictable, comfortable life. And so we need to protect ourselves. We need to develop a secure lifestyle. What would you call a secure lifestyle? On a lifestyle level, how does avoiding pain affect us? Does it limit who we're willing to let our children play with? Does it limit where we are willing to volunteer and park our car? You know, a lot of people say, well, I can't volunteer in the inner city at Harambe or wherever because my car might get broken into. Probably will. That's why we have insurance, right? You know?
We just think about ourselves. We're not thinking about anybody else. And just, we can't really have an impact on other people when we're, everything's us. And then it becomes more and more us. And then our kids and nobody else's kids. And
yeah, that is the primary outcome of trying to avoid pain in a lifestyle way, is that we have to be thinking about ourselves and our kids all the time, and we can't be thinking about other people. We just don't have room in our brains to be going in both of those directions at once. Yes?
It takes away from making sacrifices.
It takes away from making sacrifices, right? Why would you want to have that snotty kid down the street at home at your house for dinner every night just because his parents aren't home? You know, it takes us away from making sacrifices because we're afraid of maybe the influence that child might have on ours and all those other kinds of things. Now, do we need to be careful as parents? Of course. I'm not talking about throwing our children out to the lions. I'm just saying that there are an awful lot of ways that we can open our vision and allow our children to suffer. And sometimes people think that it sounds like a horrible thing to say one of the most important things in parenting is to allow your child to suffer. But we just looked at Joseph and Daniel, and what was the thing that caused in them the clarity of vision and the clarity of their faith for them to prosper? It was suffering. And one of the reasons, frankly, that we took our kids to the Amazon many years ago, in spite of all the fears that we had, was that we didn't want them to grow up in a comfortable American life and not have a social conscience. Not that you have to go overseas for that to occur, but that was one of the things that was really deeply on our hearts. We wanted them to suffer. Now that sounds horrible, and we wouldn't have put it in exactly those terms at the time. I wouldn't have said it exactly that way if, you know, Franklin County Children's Services might have come after us. But it was a clear decision, knowing that suffering would occur, and praying that those hearts would be touched in such a way that suffering would bring strength and courage. And it works, you know, not just in my life and in my children's lives, but I have seen it over and over and over again in the lives of expatriates who live overseas, in the lives of people here who work in dangerous places in the inner city, in lives of people who are sacrificially involved in the lives of other people in many, many ways, even if they live in the suburbs, and it works. It's an infallible spiritual principle. When we put ourselves out at risk into the hands of God, He is there. And He produces for us a confidence and an ability to thrive and move ahead and be concerned about Him and His purposes that no other experience can produce. We need to let our kids suffer. And that can be small things, and unfortunately sometimes it's bigger things. But there's nothing wrong with suffering, and it is our fear of pain. It is our fear of pain that drives the neurotic anxiety that so many of our children have as adolescents and young adults. You know, the anxiety problems and drug problems and so on are fueled by this inner sense of, I can't cope. What if something happens to me? Life is just too empty. And when we can fill that with wonderful experiences, some of which involve some level of suffering, then it clarifies our children's vision and allows them to focus on the things that are important in life. So one of the things about the secure lifestyle is that it limits our perspective of what's possible, and it causes us often to say, I can't do that. I can't do that. I don't want to do that. How does fear make us vulnerable? How does fear make us vulnerable commercially? All of you as young parents have experienced this. How does fear make us vulnerable commercially? It's kind of amazing, isn't it? Yes.
Buy.
Yeah, I mean, you got to have everything. And if you don't, your child might die, you know? I heard this wonderful story on NPR about how car seats really don't help after the child is a certain number of pounds or 2 years old or whatever, car seats have absolutely no impact whatsoever on survival rates in crashes as long as you have a good seatbelt in place. And this guy did this study. He hired the same crash dummy company that proves that you have to have all these fancy car seats. And they did this study, and he wasn't allowed to quote their company in his report because the company was afraid they'd lose the money from the car seat people. But they did the exact same crashes, and they used the exact same kind of dummies, and they proved that you don't even need all those seats. So why? You know, we are commercially vulnerable, because if there's any possibility that this new, more expensive thing could produce a little bit more safety, then we feel compelled by people. What would people think of us if we didn't do that? You know, I'm sure you guys can think of a lot more examples since you're more in the commercial thing than I am. What about emotionally? How does fear make us emotionally vulnerable?
I think it's because you're always up and down about everything. You're not, you know, stable.
That's a really good way to put it. I hadn't thought of it in quite those terms. Did you have something also?
You're not alone.
You're not
alone. The only one that's dealing with your fear. So you're able to go and talk to a friend.
Yeah, but the way that makes us vulnerable is this whole up and down thing. Is if we're focused on safety, then everything is a threat. But if we're focused on who God is and focused on looking for opportunities, then everything is something that we can potentially walk into with God. It's a whole completely different mindset. Yes?
I was thinking relationally, I feel like I just experienced something like this where after a week or something of what I realized was basically letting my kids kind of run all over me and I'm the slave to them and whatever, you know, including husband. So I'm like, why do I feel so depressed and just foggy and out of it? And anyway, so the Lord kind of revealed to me that I was paying a price emotionally by protecting myself and not disciplining them well and not holding the line. And
wow, that's
so
great.
Yeah, so then I start to hold line a little bit more, and this is funny. So basically I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm the one in charge. And so I give whatever, I did the mom thing, and my 4-year-old was like, you pooped in my eye and you don't love me anymore. Anyway, so it was hilarious, but I think God kind of showed me that I'm going to pay emotionally anyway, whether it be me being in charge or them being, you know, like I'm going to pay because we pay at the hand of sinners, but am I going to be paying, you know, having been aligned with God's will? Or
that's a great example.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole discipline issue is hugely difficult. It's so much more complicated than it's ever been because, I'll just say one thing and then I'd like to get this one, because we are told that children are so fragile, and so discipline has become incredibly complex because we have to tell them that they're wrong, but we have to still be sure that we don't hurt their feelings or make them feel guilty. Now, that's a really, really rough thing. You know, so we are emotionally vulnerable when we have this kind of mentality, you know, that they can't be hurt, they can't experience pain, they can't experience shame for anything that they've done. Yes?
I'm not sure if this is where this fits in, but I have seen, I have a friend who has let fear take over her life. She came around to our home group for a while and doesn't anymore, but I've seen this pass on to her child.
Uh-huh.
And I think we need to remember that our kids do watch what we do, and they, you know, they may not listen to what we say, but they watch what we do.
Yeah,
and
do.
We can pass this fear on to our children.
Yep, and that's one of the things that we do have that stewardship with our children, is deciding what we're going to pass on to them. I know I was terrified of water. I couldn't put my face in the water for years because my mother was afraid of water. And then I went to a Girl Scout camp when I was about 11, and I was forced to learn how to swim because you were not allowed to be at the camp and not learn how to swim. And I loved it. And I totally lost my fear of water, and now I like to swim in the ocean and whatever, you know. But it was so interesting to me how in such a short period of time I completely lost something that I thought, you know, this is the way I am, you know. But it was a fear, a learned fear, and it wasn't really grounded. Anyway, all right, how about spiritually? How does fear make us vulnerable spiritually? I think we've touched on this a bit already, but any more ideas? Let me just say that the main way that we become vulnerable spiritually when we give in to fear is that we become disconnected. We disconnect from the confidence of being God's child. When we live in fear, we disconnect from the confidence of being God's child. And that is a huge vulnerability. Because if we disconnect from the confidence of being God's child, what are we disconnecting from, or what are we leaving ourselves open to? We're leaving ourselves open to, who was it said it all about the lies? You know, we leave ourselves open to all the lies. You know, that God doesn't care, that we're alone, that, you know, this is going to destroy us and all that kind of stuff. All right, so living with the prospect of pain, we need to answer the question in our life, what does pain mean? What does pain mean in our lives? You know, if from a medical perspective, you know, you have pain in your body, it means there's something wrong that you need to pay attention to. Emotionally, oftentimes, that's what pain also means. But pain in general, the fact of suffering in general, it just means that we live in a fallen and broken world. It just means that, thank God, our life here is temporary. It just means that we're more dependent on other people and more dependent upon God. And pain in and of itself isn't really necessarily a bad thing. It isn't necessarily something that we need to feel upset about because we experience pain. So let's talk a little bit about living with the prospect of pain. One of the things that's really helpful with pain is anticipating it and having realistic expectations. I don't know if the slide's in here or not because I don't remember anymore, but there's the idea about going to the dentist, okay? Now, I personally have issues with going to the dentist, and I apologize ahead of time to anyone whose husband is a dentist or who is a dentist or a dental hygienist or whatever, but I have real issues with going to the dentist. So you could either, what would be better though? To like drive me up to the door and say, oh look, it's dentist day, you know, get out of the car. Or to tell me a week ahead of time, okay, you're gonna have a dentist appointment on Thursday, you know, at 10 o'clock and, you know, blah, blah, blah. What do you think? What would be the easier way? Well, so I suppose it depends on the person. Maybe you should just dump me out the car door. But in general, it's helpful with our children if we help them to learn to anticipate pain. If we help them to learn that pain is normal and that to have realistic expectations about life. You know, they need to know, to understand the germ theory of disease. You will get sick. When you get sick, it's really a bummer. I'll try to take care of you as best I can, but you will feel bad, and then you will get better. And they need to understand about gravity and physics and the forces of momentum. And yes, and they need to understand, yeah, you're gonna fall off your bike. Yes, you probably will fall out of that tree sooner or later. You know, and these kinds of things, and have realistic expectations, you know, and just say, oh yeah, I went to the emergency room 8 times when I was little, you know, hey, you know. Now, I don't want to be totally cavalier about this because these things are upsetting and they're traumatic for us in a lot of ways. But when our kids have realistic expectations about life, it allows them to be a lot freer about what they can do. But then there's also realistic expectations about people. We need to help them understand that people are loving and caring and generous. And they're also mean and selfish and cruel. And when we have realistic expectations about, yes, your friend just said that you, you know, put poop in my eye or whatever, you know, okay, he's having a bad day. That's normal. And so we need to help normalize pain and normalize things for our children to say, yeah, that's the way it is. Yeah, that happened to me too. Not in a way that blows it off their fears, and not in the way that makes them feel like they shouldn't bring these things up, but just to normalize it and say, yeah, I'm really sorry that you're having a bad day. You know, if somebody said something like that to me, I'd really feel crushed too. Fortunately, that's not the end of the story with this friendship. You know, we can move ahead. Another thing is developing the character and skills for dealing with pain. What do you think the most important character quality is for someone to have if they're going to have to be dealing with difficulty and suffering and pain? What?
Steadfastness?
Okay. Sure, it's a word. Steadfastness is a super important thing. It means that they're going to stay steady on the vision. Yeah?
Perseverance.
Yeah, I think those are pretty similar. The ability to work and to do things in spite of the fact that they don't feel well, to that day that our kid gets up and they're not feeling well, and maybe they can't go to school because they have a fever, but maybe they still can do something else, or that day that they're just tired and they don't want to clean up their room, just to say, you know, you really can do it, or that hike that you go on that they don't really have to be carried the whole time. You know, we can teach them perseverance. What else is a key factor in combating the things that can overwhelm us if we have pain? Any other ideas?
Humility.
Humility? Now, that's interesting. How does humility fit in here?
Why would I
I guess, who am I to think that I shouldn't suffer or I shouldn't experience these painful experiences? And
that is really good. Humility. I hadn't even thought about that. Who am I to think that I should be different from everybody else in the world? And that implies that we're telling them what everybody else in the world lives like. That implies that we're getting them out of just our comfortable homes and either seeing up close and personal at a nursing home or a shelter or a food pantry what other people go through, or at very minimum exposing them to what the rest of the world kind of living conditions that they have. So yeah, who am I? The other thing I think is really significant is gratitude. I really, really, really believe that one of the key, probably the key, other than forming that relationship with Jesus, the key to a good life is gratitude. Because we're able to focus on the wonderful things that God's done for us, and we're not on the looking always for the negative things that are happening, but we're focused on being grateful for the things that happen as well. Coping, they need practice and guidance. You know, we need to come up with a way of alerting our children to the fact that there's an issue, kind of like, you know, the Apollo 13 famous quote, what was it, Houston, we have a problem? Okay, sometimes with our kids we can do that. We can say, huh, we have a dilemma. Okay, it looks like the garage door won't open, or we're out of gas, or we've had a flat tire, or something has come up, and instead of being all upset about it and like, oh my God, we can say, ooh, we have a dilemma. Okay, here's the facts. Does anybody have any suggestions? Or here are the facts. I'm going to have to ask you to sit still because I'm going to do this or this or this. You know, and just like being kind of chill when we have these routine difficulties helps them to learn to sort through, prioritize, oh, this is not life-threatening, and to move through, how do I deal with pain? A lot of times we like to say that children are resilient. And when do you most hear people say that? When somebody's getting divorced. That was the thing that most came to my mind when I think about this idea, children are resilient. People say that all the time when they're getting divorced. Now, why do they say that? Many, many times it's because so that they can justify making all these enormous changes in a child's life. They say, oh, children are resilient, he'll get over it, you know, when divorced, or if they get a new job and they're going to move to a new city where the kids don't know anybody, oh, children are resilient, they're fine. Or even at death, you know, oh, grandma, well, that's, you know, children are resilient, they'll be fine. Now, it's kind of true that children are very resilient in a lot of ways. It's also true that children are fragile. And when do we focus on when our children are fragile? When do we treat them like they're fragile? When they're irritated, oh, honey, it's okay, honey, you know, don't be irritated. When they're experience some kind of failure or rejection, we forget that children are resilient, and then we go with the children are fragile. You know, and we think that because they've been rejected by their friend, you know, it's really a major disaster, or because they didn't get the grade that they wanted. When they're bored, we think, oh no, I have to intervene, I have to do something with this, you know, my child is in distress. When they have a moderate illness, I'm not talking about a life-threatening illness, but when they have some kind of moderate illness, we treat them like they're fragile. And it communicates to them, you don't know how to cope, which is, of course makes them feel fragile. So part of what we have to think about is, are they fragile or not? I mean, what, you know, are they resilient or are they fragile? Anybody have any ideas? Are they resilient or are they fragile? Yes.
I believe that children adapt to the way that we treat them. I mean, if you're babying your child, then they're going to feel like they're fragile in those situations. And if you're, you know, making your child, you know, like, oh, you're okay, brush it off. Then they're going to get off the floor and brush their knees off, and they're not going to cry as much as if you went, oh, are you okay?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's totally, I think that the way the child reacts has a lot to do with the way that you're reacting as well.
Yeah, exactly. We can help our children to become, there is no dichotomy, they're fragile, they're resilient. It's a false dichotomy that I just made up. But the point is that we basically are teaching them whether or not they are resilient or whether they are fragile by the way we respond to the things that happen in their lives. So that's great. Okay, let's move on. The element of surprise, yeah, there's the dentist thing. Ah. Anyway, we'll move on past that. Helping them to anticipate. Now, this is supposed to be a parenting class, and I realize it's a whole lot more about other things. You know, we're not going to talk about how to anticipate a specific thing, but I have to say that the most important way that we can help our children anticipate difficulty in life is by developing in them realistic expectations and a realistic worldview. Okay, so what is a worldview? What does that word mean? We have excess eyes on it all the time and things like that. So what is a worldview? What's a worldview? Yes.
Is it kind of like how our world operates or what our experiences were and that kind of thing?
It's actually like that, but it's bigger than that. A worldview is how do we perceive reality? What do we think is real? Like a worldview, a rational materialistic worldview is that somehow life got set into motion and our universe is out there and it exists and we exist, but there is no cause, and after we die there will be nothing. And so nothing really has ultimate importance because we really aren't attached to anything. That's a worldview, a materialistic worldview. It's only here if you can touch it and there is nothing else. Okay, but since we have a theistic worldview, we can answer the most important question in the universe, and that is, are we alone? And we can answer that question, no, we are not alone. And so the more clearly we can teach our children a theistic worldview, a worldview that says somebody made us, somebody put us, our lives into motion, somebody is walking by our side, and somebody will take us home. The more deeply we can help them understand that worldview, the more stable their entire life will be. The key questions are, am I alone? No. And is God good? Yes. And the second one is actually harder to answer than the first one, okay? It's a lot harder to answer than the first one because things happen that are bad. And so we have to learn to help our children to think through the fact that even though bad things happen, God is still good. And that takes a lot of reading, and I would refer you to Strobel, The Case for Faith. He has an excellent couple chapters on this very issue that you're not going to read to your two-year-old, but when you have it, you know, really ingrained in your own thinking, it helps, it's easier to relate to your children about that. But why are these the real questions of life? It's because when you get right down to it, there is no other thing. And if we can teach our children that God really is there and God really is taking care of us, their anxiety and their stress level will be so much lower going through life, and they will have so much more resilience. I remember we used to sit at our house when our kids were really little and it would rain. I'd say, oh, isn't it wonderful that Jesus gave us this house? Look outside, it's all wet. You know, and here we are, it's dry, it's warm. You know, when it would snow, same thing. You know, when we'd go out in our car, wow, we don't have to walk, we've got this car, you know. I mean, we can imprint in our children's lives from the very, very earliest years this idea of gratitude that God is taking care of us. So sometimes we're so busy teaching our children that the world is a dangerous place and don't do this and don't do that, that we forget that in the grand scheme of things, we are safe. In the grand scheme of our lives, we are safe. Because Jesus is coming to take us home. And nothing can change that. And it is so security building for our own hearts that we're then able to pass that on to our children. In the grand scheme of things, we are safe. Nothing can take us away from Jesus. And it sounds so simplistic, but you know, it really is. We are not alone, and God is good. And so it's so important for us as parents to have that perspective ourselves and to remind ourselves consistently of that perspective. And then all the how to and how not to kind of things, you can kind of filter out for yourself in each individual life. But we need to, we think a lot about what is the future going to hold. And the important thing we need to know is that we don't know. And it's not our job to know. We don't know, and it doesn't matter. Really. I mean, we're not likely to get stuffed in the trunk like Joseph and carried off to Mexico, but we don't know what the world, the future holds, and we don't need to know, because we can live today with the security that God has given us, and with the security that whatever comes the next day, God will be taking care of us. I see children starting to amass out there, so I'm going to stop here in a second. You might be asking, is she ever going to say anything practical at this point? I will just say that children learn to be afraid or not afraid and confident or not confident by watching us. My son broke his arm once when we lived in Brazil, and when his cast came off, he immediately started to cry. And later, and I thought, well, it should be healed by now, so after we left the hospital, I said, well, honey, why did you start to cry? Did it hurt when they took the cast off? And he said, no, it didn't hurt. Well, then why did you cry? He said, because I looked at your face. Well, I was freaked out because I saw immediately what I had suspected, that they hadn't set it right. And there was a huge angle in that bone, and it was going to have to be reset. And so I was just like, you know, I didn't say anything. I didn't think that, you know, but they see that. There was a time, because of our ups and downs, you never know when the dollar's going to be up and the hay's going to be down and the cruzeiro's going to be up, and sometimes you don't have any money for, little lunch things at school, and sometimes you're able to go out for, a pizza dinner for a birthday. So, and sometimes we live in a house with no electricity, and sometimes we live in a house that is really pretty nice. And so I remember one of my kids coming up to me one day and saying, Mom, I just really don't get it. I just want to understand, are we rich or are we poor? Because sometimes, compared to the people we were living with, we were very, very rich. And then other times, compared to the people they went to school with, we were very, very poor. And it was a very confusing thing. And so these are wonderful, wonderful questions. You know, we should be answering those questions even if the kids haven't thought to ask them. You know, and to say, hey, you know what? We're rich. You know, and explain that. Because instead of, so many times we in middle class America, what do? We think we're poor. Oh, there's taxes. Oh, there's this. Oh, there's that. And oh, I don't have enough money. You know, and we need to keep reminding ourselves, we are rich. We are at the top 93rd percentile of the entire world. Everyone who's sitting in this room who lives in a house is rich. And there's no other way to look at it. You know, we might not be as rich as the guy down the street, but we are rich. And those are the kind of things that we can build into their lives. You know, when a kid is going to school, should I be worried? Well, it's normal to be worried, but actually, you don't need to be worried, and to bringing up these questions for them ahead of time. All right, I'm going to conclude here with this idea that if we could only give one gift to our children, only give one gift to them in their whole life other than helping them to learn about the love of Jesus, it would be that security and contentment are not based on what we have and how things are going. And we can pass that on to them. And so then our children's lives will not be mastered by fear. Fear is a big thing, but it matters what we believe, it matters what we believe, but what we believe won't matter unless we really think about it. Does that make sense? It matters what we believe, but what we believe won't matter if we don't give it thought on a regular daily basis. And that's why funerals are such a wonderful thing, because it causes us to think about what really matters. All right. I actually got done at 11:03. Any questions? Now that we've had such a heavy conversation, any final thoughts? Yes.
I think just one thing I've learned in the last few years is that it's really important to have a vision mm-hmm. out of a painful situation, because mm-hmm. I've had a couple that were really difficult, and it's really helped to have a vision out of it to see what good can come out of this, mm-hmm. even though you have to go through the pain to get there.
And sometimes we can't really get that vision by ourselves. A lot of times we need to just ask other people, wow, what do you see here? What could God possibly be doing? Or even sometimes you have to look back for a few years and say, wow, that was horrible. And look at what these cool things have come out of it. Yeah. Other people's testimony about that is really helpful.